Hello, friends and listeners. It's Jim, and I just want to let you know that WVXU and Cincinnati Public Radio are in the midst of our fall fun drive. And so if you value this program and the other programs you get from Cincinnati Public Radio, WVXU, and WGUC, please consider taking a few minutes and, you know, making a donation, $5, $10, $20, whatever you think you can afford. It really helps us tremendously to create the kind of programs that we hope you enjoy. All you have to do is go to one of our websites, like WVXU.org, and click on the button that says Donate Now. It's that simple, and it means a lot. Thanks. Welcome to Local Exposure, a podcast about music and the greater Cincinnati scene. I'm Jim Nolan. As WVXU is currently in the middle of our annual fall fun drive, I thought it'd be fun to revisit one of my all-time favorite interviews. This is an encore presentation of an interview I did in August of 2015 with David Lowery and Johnny Hickman from the band Cracker. At the time, Cracker was celebrating their 25th anniversary, so David and Johnny stopped by the studios prior to their show that night at the Southgate House Revival. We talked about the band's longevity, the music industry, David's passionate campaign for artist royalties from online streaming sources, and the band's involvement with the production of the movie Sharknado 3, Oh Hell No. I hope you enjoy this interview as much as I did. And as always, thanks for listening.
Say goodbye to Miss Jenny sleeping on a subway grate. Say goodbye to all the ladies waiting for the tricks to show. Got $100 more than I need to score. Got $100 just enough to get me home. Yeah, I'm going back home to the cotton fields, to the almond grove, to the old homestead. See my mom, pa, my big brother Jack. Went to Kandahar, but he never came back. Came from Maricopa, had no family left. Worked at Port of Oakland, fell in with the narco set. Ended up a junkie living in my brother's car. Don't shed a tear for me, homemade so far. Yeah, I'm going back home to the cotton fields, to the almond groves, to the old homestead. See my mom and pa, my big brother Jack. Went to Kandahar, but he never came back. No, never come back. Boulevard, ladies, don't you weep and moan. I've gone to a better place off the dirty streets. Mr. Patel, won't you send my ashes home? spread them in the old family almond grove. Yeah, I'm going back home to the cotton fields, to the almond groves, to the old homestead. See my mom and pop, my big brother Jack. He went to Kandahar, but he never came back. Going back home to the cotton fields, to the almond groves, to the old homestead. See my mom and pop, my big brother Jack. Went to Kandahar, but he never came back. Gonna see him now.
My guests today are David Lowery and Johnny Hickman, the driving force of Cracker. Thank you for coming here and welcome to Cincinnati.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Tell me a little bit of history about Cracker. How long have you known each other? How long have you been playing together?
We've known each other since 1978 or 1979. We, though, really only played together since about 1990, although we dabbled around in some other projects before and then. You know, so yeah, that's getting on 38 years that we've known each other, something like that. Yeah.
I remember years ago when the Rolling Stones had their 25th anniversary and they made a big, huge celebration about it. The Grateful Dead made a big deal with their 25th anniversary tour. Cracker's now been together 25 years and still going. And how do you sustain it?
Well, one of the things about Cracker is that it's just the two of us. We set it up that way in the beginning. We have a circle, not to downplay or discount anybody that's ever played with us, but it's organized differently than a lot of other bands. I was in a band with six members before that. Might have heard of them, Camper Van Beethoven. We sort of had a semi-consensus way of working, but it was really just sort of anarchy until somebody seized power and then got something done. So we did it this way on purpose, like there'd just be two of us. And then we just kind of have a loose sort of lineup that just sort of morphed and changed, because that's the way bands always work. There's the people that you play with live, there's your friends that you jam with, people that might record with you. It's almost like there's always like three circles with a band. There's like a core of the songwriters, it's kind of the people you play with, and that's your greater pool of peers, right? And those three circles are really what makes a band. And so we never structured the band to be anything other than that. And so we make the albums with the people we want to make the albums with and tour with the people that are around. Or, you know, the interesting thing about this tour is that it's this is the Bakersfield. There's two discs, the Berkeley and the Bakersfield disc. The Bakersfield disc, this is the Bakersfield band touring with us. I mean, they're really from Athens, Georgia, but they are just as good at the rock stuff as they are at the country stuff. And they kind of bring this other take on the rock stuff. And so it's just, it makes the band constantly evolve and morph and change into things that it wasn't before, like a living, healthy organism does. You know, we're not a fossil, right? That's what living organisms do. They constantly adapt and change. And so I think that's actually the secret. It's just this dumb little thing that we did in the beginning, but it's allowed us to stay together for a long time and make sort of a large body of music and, you know, sort of span different styles and yeah.
I think the way you express that is very accurate, because mm-hmm. I always saw it as an evolution. When you mm-hmm. look at albums like Kerosene Hat as opposed to the new album, and I think it's that, like you said, that structure or lack of structure, depending on how you want to mm-hmm. look at it, that system of circles that allows you to even make an album like
Berkeley to Bakersfield.
Yeah, well, Berkeley, and that, you know, it's very important. The formal, what formal organization there is of the band, yes, specifically allows us to make an album like Berkeley to Bakersfield, because Berkeley, we took our rhythm section from the Kerosene Hat album, went into Michael's studio in Berkeley. That's the reason it's called Berkeley. It's really, it's just like, hey, let's jam and see if we can write some songs again, right? And, you know, we bang out this album basically in 3 days with those guys. At the same time, we're working in Athens, Georgia on this other project that sort of started before that, you know, the country project with a different set of musicians, and getting this you know, we call it Bakersfield, but it's a sort of a general Americana record. There are Bakersfield country elements to the album, but it's a general sort of Americana album. And yeah, if you had a formal, you know, hey, it's the four same, you know, two guitars, bass and drums, you know, it's us against the world. And, you know, you don't get that kind of floating sort of creativity. You know, it's like a kind of a controlled anarchy is what we have, right? We're organized very much like small tech startup. Really, seriously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a Kickstarter.
We're organized very much like one of those. So.
Well, and I know you're touring as Cracker, but you made reference to Camper Van Beethoven. And you don't see Camper as like this precious little snow globe that's sitting on a shelf and you take it down every once in a while, because you're still producing music and albums under the Camper Van Beethoven.
Oh, yeah. We just did two songs for Sharknado 3, Oh Hell No, which is funny in a lot of ways, but perfect for the band. Here you have this sort of self-consciously sort of outrageous movie, outrageously sort of unbelievable, like, movie franchise with a very anarchic spirit, a very, you know, anarchic director, and that just fit really well with Camper. It was almost kind of a miracle that we got together with that. So yeah.
Well, when you have a song in your head, how do you make that decision? It's a Camper song, it's a Cracker song, or how does that evolve?
You can usually just sort of tell. I mean, the Camper songs tend to be written kind of collaboratively with the four of us in a room, whereas with Cracker, you know, we sometimes write a lot of stuff separately, sometimes we write stuff together. The Camper stuff, I mean, if I start out with an idea, I can usually tell at the beginning whether it should be thrown to the Camper crowd or whether it should stay over with me and Johnny in Cracker. I mean, obviously it can, you know, if you have an instrumental in your head called ZZ Top Goes to Egypt, that probably is pretty obvious that that belongs with Camper Van Beethoven, you know. But I mean, there's similar, there's a lot of similarities too. The last Camper album has a song called Darken Your Door, which we could probably very much have repurposed for this Berkeley to Bakersfield disc on the Cracker side, but we didn't. That Gum You Like was Back in Style, which started out as a Cracker thing, but Camper kind of fleshed it out in a much weirder way, you know, and
which I was totally happy about. It was like, wow.
Well, Johnny, how do you approach the songwriting process when you know you're doing either the Bakersfield part or the Berkeley part, or is that even in your mindset? Are you just creating?
I'll do the same thing. There have been a handful of songs that I did on my solo records that we reinvented as Cracker songs, and sometimes it works that way, or a lot of times I'll just have a riff. I'll have a sort of this muscular sort of root riff. You know, I think along the lines of like Zeppelin's my influences, or Neil Young or something, where you have this big melodic motif. And then David will take it from there and create a song within that sort of thing. And it's no real set way that we work. I mean, it really varies. I mean, David will have a song pretty much complete, and I'll just add some good embellishment to it to sort of flesh it out. You know?
And there's a real serious Jekyll and Hyde kind of dichotomy going on between the two. I mean, you have very beautiful melodic songs like the one you just played, Almond Grove, and then you have on the other disc or the other side, however we want to view it, you know, songs like Torches and Pitchforks or March of the Billionaires, very right. angry songs.
Right, very punk rock sort of influenced or protesty something, yeah. Well, I mean, these are all, I mean, I think that it's not always me talking, right? And most of the time it's just characters like I invent in my head and then I let them speak. And which is weird, sounds like, you know, schizophrenic, but it's actually a really good way to work a song out and let it, it tends to shake off a lot of the cliches and stuff like that if you do that, right? You shake off a lot of the cliched phrases and stuff like that that you might fall into, you know, like repeating, you know.
But you mentioned your characters. Your characters are often very desperate and just oozing with pathos.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a song on the new album, the song I'm Sorry Baby, which I have had, I mean, I don't know how to say this, and I'm probably not going to come out right, but it's sort of been a parade of misery since I wrote that song, because people will come up to me after the show and go, hey, that song completely matches like this divorce I just went through. And it's just, you know, I just broke up with, you know, my girlfriend of 16 years, or my, you know, my husband and I got divorced after 12 years or something like that. And I've been getting that a lot with that song. And it's cool that like people relate to it so personally, but sometimes I'm like, oh my God, what did I get myself into? You know, it's just like, it's deeply confessional stuff that I'm getting from a lot of, you know, somebody just pull me aside and go, I got to tell you this, you know, send me a Facebook message, or, you know, it's like instant message on Twitter or something like that, you know, with this story that you're going, oh man, I'm so sorry, but
thank you.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder sometimes if that's part of the appeal of Cracker, is that there's these characters who are so have such a come from such a dark place, mm-hmm. that people either identify with it, or that they feel like, okay, there's people out there that have it worse than I do. It's like, well, going to your favorite dive
bar.
Yeah,
we hear that sometimes. Yeah, but we balance it with the funny stuff too. I mean, sure. We also create characters that are kind of laughable, likable, laughable people too. I mean, you know, so there's a balance. It's not all darkness, but sometimes the darkness. There's a song from the first record called "Another Song About the Rain." That, you know, it's pretty obviously like knife in the heart. You know, and it's to this day the same kind of thing. Like, oh, that song coming. The guy that directed our video said that I just listened to that song over and over for a week. That's how I got through that breakup. And like, as a songwriter, that's sort of the goal, is to, you know, have people, you know, identify with something. But yeah, sometimes it's something pretty dark. You know, it's, you know, it's part of what you do. You know,
The crazy thing is, you know, the Almond Grove song that we just played, like just last night, we played that song. I was just in some coffee shop and there was these two guys walking around, like giving people their CDs. I was like, this guy's got a big pair right there. You know what I mean?
Young guys.
And I went over and talked to them and I was like, I've been in the music for 35 years. What do you guys do? And they're like, oh, we play country music and, you know, we're just a duo right now. We're just trying to get people to listen to our stuff. And so I was like, come down to soundcheck. I'll put you guys to work. Right. And anyway, we played Almond Grove at soundcheck and they freaked out because they were like, they turned out to be army officers and like having been in Kandahar and lost people and seen what it, you know, did to the family and stuff like that. I mean, that's intense when you get like suddenly start connecting with people like that. And they're just like that. Wow. And then they're, one of the guys is from the same area that the song takes place in. And that's intense, you know, that stuff happens.
But you know you're making a connection to another human being, and that's a magical thing.
They're our biggest fans now. We had breakfast with them this morning.
I mean, but that's something not every human can say, is I was able to touch somebody on that kind of level.
Yeah.
Is there another song you want to share with us?
Yeah, sure. Let's do this. This is also from the... I mean, we're just going to play some stuff off the new album. So this is much more lighthearted. This is our tribute to kind of the Eastern California, you know? Not Northern California, not Southern California, inland, sort of the country, western part of the state, which is... I always consider myself from Eastern California, so...
That's where we grew up.
Yeah.
It's real.
Okay, here we go.
There ain't no palm trees where I come from, no big waves crashing on the shore, no gridlock traffic, no movie stars now. In the part of California I come from, we got oil fields in the Central Valley. We got cowboys out in the Mojave, Salinas Valley, yeah, where I come from. We got farms far as the eye can see. I got good friends out in Texas, and I got family in Tennessee. But this here country boy's from California. There ain't no place I'd rather be. There ain't no place I'd rather be. From Paso Robles to the Owens Valley, from Mount Shasta on down to Salton Sea, that's where we pick these guitars, that's where we write these songs. There ain't no place where I'd rather be. I got good friends out in Texas, and I got family in Tennessee. But this here country boy's from California. There ain't no place I'd rather be. There ain't no place I'd rather be. There ain't no palm trees. There ain't no movie stars. In the part of California I come from.
David Lauer and Johnny Hickman. Tonight you'll be playing at the Southgate House in Newport, Kentucky.
Yeah, we're excited.
This will be a new experience for you because it's a new building.
Yeah, we actually haven't been here in a while. I don't know why we haven't been to the Cincinnati area in a while. We were just looking at that. We were like, we couldn't figure out last time we were here, so...
Yeah. I couldn't tell you either. It's been quite a while. But
we used to come here all the time. Yeah. So it's good to be back.
Good. And you just were in Indianapolis and I think Louisville before that, right?
So yeah, we're going to Louisville tomorrow.
Louisville tomorrow. Okay. So you're kind of doing the whole Midwest circuit right now.
Zigzagging. That's right. Yeah, our way through.
It's been good?
Yeah.
No problems.
It's been great. We've had a great year on this record. So, yeah.
When you're on tour, obviously you got a lot of time in the van and spending... Do you read books? What do you do to kill the time?
I read books, meditate, sometimes come up with an idea for a song and just write a line down or title. Hey, that could be funny or this could be that. Or,
yeah. Are you reading anything good?
I'm reading a book by a rock journalist from the 60s who kind of went from being a rock journalist into the more radical side of the 60s and the Abbie Hoffmans and the Jerry Rubins. And it's pretty interesting, yeah.
Just okay.
I was a little kid when that, little tiny kid when it was going on, but it's interesting to look back and, wow. So this is why this happened. This is the trajectory towards that. And yeah, it's fun, you know.
It's fun, for me, it's fun to see history as a living thing. It's difficult as you're younger because you see it as this thing that you don't want to deal with. It's a subject in school. Mm-hmm. But as you get older, history becomes this, wow, it's something I'm a part of.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were talking earlier, you have kids, you both have kids. Mm-hmm. You know, it's something I want to instill in my kids is, you know, this is the lame cliche, but if, you know, you got to know where you're from to know what's
get them off the video games and into a
yes.
book. I insist that before my son plays video games, he has to read and he has to report back to me on what he just read. Mm-hmm. You know, my that's just the way it is. Sorry, pal.
Yeah, right. So as we were saying before, you've been together about 25 years and you've seen a lot of changes in the music industry, if you like.
Yeah.
I hate to call it the industry, but it truly is.
Yeah, of course industry. Yeah, absolutely.
What sticks out in your mind is what...
Well, you know, I have a blog called The Tricordist, right, where we write about artist rights and stuff like that. And that occupies... He was talking about what he does in the van. I edit a blog. And I also, for some crazy reason, at 53, decided to finish my doctorate. So working on a dissertation. But put that aside for a minute. The odd thing about it is... You know, look, my wife's family, let's see, my this is going to relate back, I promise, okay? I got to get out a little on a tangent, but my mother-in-law worked for Sam Phillips, Sun Records, right? And, you know, you always hear these stories about how artists, you know, back in those days, they would, you know, come to the record company and go, hey, my song's got a big hit. And they're like, yeah, we're promoting it, you know. And it's like, well, don't I get any money? And they're like, well, we bought you this Cadillac. And the idea is that the Cadillac is less value than the actual royalties and stuff like that. Well, my mother-in-law worked for Sun Records and my father-in-law is a car dealer. How do you think they met? That wasn't an urban myth.
Yeah.
That's how they met. So what we're in is we're in this period of transition. You know, every 20 years or so, the music business is radically disrupted and reorganizes itself. This one's serious, though. This one's really, really challenging. I'm not sure it gets sorted out in the next 10 years or 15 years or what, but what you have now, you have this trade-off because you have absolute creative freedom, right? You put out anything you want. Record company doesn't want to put this out. Oh, well, I was going to record it on my phone and put it on YouTube, right? You know, you have absolute creative control. The trade-off is it's never been harder to get fairly compensated for your work. And a lot of it has to do with antiquated regulations, copyright rules, and just trying to figure it out, you know? I mean, you go through a period like this, it's got to be figured out. So it's kind of like we're in the 1950s again, kind of in that Cadillac period. But I don't think we're getting a Cadillac. We might be getting
there
a scooter.
There are worse bad guys now.
You know, we have a big hit and we're getting a scooter.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of where we're at right now. We're dreaming, let's get it towards Cadillac and then eventually we can work it towards something else, right?
You know, you just want to be a creative individual, and it's such a heavy burden that you have to start getting lawyers involved and dealing with contracts and getting all the mm-hmm. details just to get paid.
Well, yeah, I would hope that like the digital revolution would actually make everything more transparent and easier to get paid, and would eliminate some of the middlemen. That hasn't quite happened yet, but I'm optimistic. But I feel like it's a long slog for artists over the next 10, 15 years.
What do you feel about some artists that are being really reactionary and just saying, I'm pulling all my songs from Spotify?
Well, I understand why. I mean, here's a simple thing that people don't quite understand is that the
premium, people like are asking me, what can I do to make it easier for artists these days? Okay, well, don't use the free services, use the subscription services, because artists are always paid on percentage of revenue. Like even when we're played on a commercial television station, your revenue is somehow based on a percentage of their revenue, okay? And so if you're paying a subscription for something like Spotify, it doesn't really matter, Apple Music, it could be Slacker, it could be RDIO, any of them, the artist gets about 8 times as much as they do if you play it on a free service. So that's sort of the first step. That's what I'm trying to get people into. Is like, so I understand what the artists are doing with what they're saying. What they really should be doing is not pulling it completely from the services, but saying, hey, can I just be, you know, if they're not making enough, you know, every artist has a different business model too. I mean, you know, a big pop star can make a lot of money on the road. A band like Cracker definitely needs to be supplemented with revenue from recorded music, right? And so like for me, if I could, I would say, hey, can I just be on behind the paywall and not on the free platform because it pays so much less? I actually need a little bit more per spin for my niche product, you know? So that's what we have to work out.
But that requires the artist taking a very active...
Well, a lot of times you can't because of the contractual. Like you're signed to Universal, and then Universal has a blanket license with Spotify, and this is how your music appears, right? Although all that's in renegotiation right now. That's why it's you see a lot of news stories about that and stuff like that. So it's just a whole generation of artists have to come up that write their contracts differently. A whole generation of attorneys have to come on the scene that know to look for these issues and know to write the contracts right. It's just, you just have to have an entire new generation move in and get the rights aligned. That's the only reason that artists ever, you know, one of the best periods for artists was like the late 80s and through mid 90s, you know, because you'd had a very educated class of artists that came in that knew what to demand from their recording contracts.
I'm glad you mentioned that because my next question was going to be, do you miss MTV?
You know, I miss being able to come home and turn on the TV for a few minutes and watch just some random video by a band I would never watch before, you know?
yeah,
it's
like
not the same
Camper
as watching
Van
radio. It's not the same. Watching radio, well, I don't know. It doesn't work, you know?
But yeah, I feel like I discovered so many wonderful artists and different types of music just by doing that, just by turning it on and see what was there.
And when I go onto YouTube, I might see a video or two, but then I start getting recommended like cat videos or guy falling down videos, you know? And you're like, that's not what I came here for, you know?
Right. So I want to ask you just a little bit more about your songwriting. Mm-hmm. Once I knew you were coming into the studio, I kind of cram listened all my favorite Cracker songs. And something that really resonated with me are the lyrics. You know, he talked about how you have some of these dark characters and some of these, you know, heavy images, but just the words, the selection of words, there's a lot that you say, but there's a whole lot more that you don't say. And I think there's that, I don't know, ambiguity or vagueness to your lyrics that tells the real story behind the story. How much of that is conscious and how much just comes out of you?
I demand a certain amount of thinking from the listener, which is probably why we're not like covered by a lot of people, and we're not like, we have songs on the radio, but we're not famous. So I demand a little bit of sort of reflecting upon the lyrics and thinking about it in sort of a deeper way, because that's really where my voice is. Like I've learned over the years that when I try to over explain things, that's not me. When I try to be way too cryptic, that's not me either. And so my voice, my narrative style is to paint a picture that not all the details are filled in on, and you have to sort of think about it to get the other pieces for it, because that's rewarding. It's not like I'm trying to be a jerk to the audience or a snob or anything like that. That's just my voice. So I've had to embrace it. You have to be who you are as an artist. You have to, if you're... Yeah, I mean, you just have to be who you are as an artist, and that's why I wish I could say it was conscious, but it's just the way I write. That's just my natural slot.
And in a detail, technological way, when you actually record in the studio, going back, you know, obviously again back to Camper Van Beethoven as well as Cracker, your vocals are always very present, mm-hmm. and always very easy to hear and easy to understand. They're not muddied into the mix like some artists do. Is that a conscious decision?
Yeah, there's a lot of times no reverb on the vocals so that you can understand it. Yeah, because it was, you know, part of the thing was the words, you know. I mean, I'm not sure you need to hear every single word of Def Leppard's Pour Some Sugar on Me to dig the song, but you might have to hear all the words of When I Win the Lottery or Big Dipper to understand what's being painted. You know, did he say and or an? You know, do you have to be able to hear that stuff? And so that ends up a lot of times with no reverb, very dry in your face with a lot of the sibilant noises coming through.
and again, your lyrics are also openly very political.
Yeah, but they're not always my politics. That's one of the things about it, is like, that's what I like, is you get a character, it's like, wow, this guy's going on a rant here, you know? It's like, well, I can give you an example with King of Bakersfield, you know? I take that's on the new disc, you know, the Berkeley side, you have Torches and Pitchforks, which is like very, like, pro-union, left, workers, right kind of thing. And then you get this kind of sly little, like, sort of center-right, conservative kind of Republican kind of guy that sings King of Bakersfield, you know?
He works in the film industry, and he's just...
Yeah, he works in the film industry, and, you know, that's actually a lot of the crew are, you know, that. You know, that's an example right there, you know. So a lot of times it's not my politics. Notice I didn't say which one was my politics, right?
And that is none of my business, right?
That's another thing that I do.
One last thing I want to ask you about is I know we're, you know, you've talked about how you two are basically the core mm-hmm. of the band, but tell me about the rest of the guys in Cracker.
Well, we have, on this tour, we're using the Athens, Georgia lineup. So we've got Coco Owens on drums. Nobody calls him Coco except for us, but we're making that his stage name.
We decided.
Carlton Owens. Yeah. He's on drums. He's a monster. I mean, he just is a beast on the drums. Keep your hands and feet clear of the man when he's working. Brian Howard, who has an extremely diverse background on bass. I mean, he's just played with so many, you know, different bands stylistically and stuff like that. Comfortable playing metal and comfortable playing country music and alternative rock and whatever. Thayer Serrano, who actually is not at this show. She's on medical leave for a couple days. Unfortunately, she got a cut on her leg and it became really infected. So, but Thayer Serrano plays keyboards and sings the backing vocals, and she's an Athens based kind of session. All these people, we have a little session and touring backing musician scene in Athens, Georgia. And then, of course, there's Pistol, who is the pedal steel player, just goes by Pistol. It's great.
He's
great,
phenomenal.
Really interesting pedal steel player. I mean, he's not traditional. He can do the traditional country, but he likes to bend it a little bit. He likes to play it a little weird, as I say in the, you know, in the King of Bakersfield song. So,
where'd you find Pistol? Because he is a character.
Pistol is just, I mean, literally, there's a few studios in Athens, Georgia, and we came there to record, and we asked David Barbie and Drew, is like, hey, we need kind of an Americana band. And, you know, country and an Americana band. And we want to, you know, so he was recommended to us, okay. You know, by one of the, he actually plays on one of the Camper B-sides from the album before. That's where we first had him. So, yeah, These are just Athens, Georgia folks.
Fantastic. So then the tour wraps up when?
It really wraps up, the U.S. tour really wraps up after Labor Day. I mean, we have kind of a little bit of time off. I have to do some stuff for the university for about 10 days. So we have about 10 days off at the beginning of August, but then we're right back at it. And we play through Labor Day, and I think we'll hit Europe in the late fall, and then just kind of wind it down, you know? I'll just start doing some more writing and recording or whatever.
I think I saw there's a couple dates on the tour, not many, but there's a couple where you play with Camper Van
Beethoven. Yeah, all the West Coast stuff. We have our fan festival in... We have our festival called The Camp Out in Pioneertown, California, and that's always with Camper Van Beethoven and Cracker and all of the related bands to that. And then usually we go and play Arizona or Nevada or one of the other states nearby that we don't get to that often around that week, and that's what we're doing, yeah. So we're doing a Cracker Camper tour, basically, of the desert, which is Pioneertown, Arizona, New Mexico, yeah.
Very cool. Well, again, thank you for coming in. It's been a pleasure. Again, welcome back to Cincinnati. And what song would you like to close us out with?
Well, let's do King of Bakersfield, because we were just talking about that, because that's a character that just talks. He told me that story. Okay?
Got a double wide in my own Merlot vineyard. I got plenty of space to park my dually trucks. And I never have to deal with LA traffic. Life is good, they call me the King of Bakersfield. I work from dusk to dawn for Paramount Pictures. Set carpenter and all around handyman. Well, back in Bakersfield, I got a Sinaloan beauty. Life is good, they call me the King of Bakersfield. So we got wide open spaces for my friends to come drink beer. We got a stage in the back with a band to step in all night long. We got some motorcycle riding neighbors. We never have no trouble round here. All my friends say you live like a king out in Bakersfield. So do what you want if you ain't hurting no one. It ain't nobody's business how you live your life. Well, I'm a red state union man from California. Life is good, they call me the King of Bakersfield. Life is good, they call me the King of Bakersfield. Life is good, they call me the King of Bakersfield.
I hope you've enjoyed this encore episode of Local Exposure. If you like and appreciate the news and entertainment programming you get from 91.7 WVXU, either on air or online,
consider making a donation to our fall fund drive. You can do it right now when you visit WVXU.org. Local Exposure is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio and 91.7 WVXU. This special episode was produced by Lee Hay. Recording and engineering was done by Rick Andres. The theme music for this episode is by Scott Holmes and comes from the Free Music Archive. Find out more at freemusicarchive.com. Until next time.